We dedicate this week of the NCFMB podcast to a two-part series celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Triangle Wine Experience, benefiting the Frankie Lemon School.
You're listening to the NCFMB podcast, part of the OG Podcast Network. The NCFMB podcast takes you behind the scenes of North Carolina's food and beverage industry. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at NCFBPod. This episode sponsored in part by Food Scene. That's foodseen.com, providing professional photography, social media management, video production, and website design. And now, enjoy the show.
Let's drink to that. Cheers.
Oh, wow.
So, right. We are back.
Yeah, at the Triangle Wine Experience Trade Tasting, and we have another winner over here, out from the Sonoma Coast, visiting Ms. Jasmine Hirsch of Hirsch Vineyards.
Awesome to be here, guys.
Yeah, right on.
Thank you. This is cool.
It's fun to have you on the show. We met because of the Triangle Wine Experience about 3 years ago. I don't know if you remember meeting me, but I was running a restaurant at the time.
Of course, you came in.
I know.
Who wrote about it? Max?
You wrote about it in your diary.
Unforgettable.
But we tasted some of your wines, and I thought they were great, and I always have thought they were great through the generations, right? I mean, you were running the show now, but you took over for your dad, is that right?
Correct. The winery. My father still takes care of the vineyards.
Okay, yes. But Hirsch, I see popping up all over the place. You've been a supporter of the Triangle Wine Experience, at least in my knowledge, over the last few years. What brought you to do that?
Well, local chef Ashley Christensen.
You're fully embracing the localness wearing the Beasley's chicken and waffle hat. So,
well,
yeah.
There you go.
Continue.
I love me some Beasley's. Well, I came to North Carolina because of my distributor who, the first night I got here, he took me to Pools. He said, this is where you got to go in order to understand what's happening right now in Raleigh with food.
Yeah.
And this was about 8 years ago, I want to say. And I met Ashley for the first time, and shortly after that, she said, hey, you got to come back. You know, we throw this great party called the Triangle Wine Experience, and, you know, we have a really good time. And I thought, well, this lady seems pretty cool. I bet she throws a good party. So, you know, I thought I was coming for a party, right? And it is a party, for sure. They take really good care of us. We have a really good time. But the first year I came to Triangle Wine Experience, they took us to the Frankie Lemon School, and we got to meet the kids. And I said, oh, shit, this is like, you know, it's like a bait and switch. Like, you think you're coming to have just a good party and you know, whatever, you forget about the next day. But no, they're like singing their claws into your heart.
They tug your heartstrings.
Oh, my gosh. And they're like, now you're hooked.
Yeah.
Because you meet the kids and you see what the teachers are doing over there. And you see this community of Raleigh and the Triangle, and they have been able to take their community and their sense of community and their commitment to their community and expand it to include all of us. And,
right.
You know, California for sure, strong group of California winemakers, but now you're seeing people coming from France and Italy, and there's a gentleman here from South America pouring his wine. So the expansion of the community here through the action of Triangle Wine Experience and Frankie Lemon and through wine, right?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just been extraordinary. So that's how. Ashley.
She was your catalyst.
She was the catalyst.
As she is for a lot of great things to come down here.
Correct.
But let's just take a minute to honor that. The Frankie Lemon School, which is a school that makes it easier for a lot of these special needs kids and special needs families. So if anybody wants to get involved, you know, you can look on Frankie School. I think frankielemonschool.org, is it?
Correct.
We'll have to put that in.
Frankielemonschool.org.
Yeah. And even last night we were at the Lyoko dinner and we heard a woman who has both her kids, unfortunately, had to go through the Frankie Lemon School, but she was just so happy because that school was available. But it's just for those of you out there, it's expensive. It's expensive to host a school that helps kids with special needs. So if you can donate next year, or you can just go online, or next year get involved in the Triangle Wine Experience.
Just have dinner there. That's all you got to do. Just
yeah,
buy
seriously.
Tickets and have dinner. It's like the easiest way to contribute because you get a great time. You get something back too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the selfless, selfish thing to do, but it's amazing. I mean, Eric Surface, one of the investors at St. Rock, was talking about how the state only funds about, was it 20%
yep.
of what is necessary for all these kids to be able to be funded.
Appropriate services.
Yeah, so this Triangle Wine Experience, is like a 4-day event, culminating in a big gala fundraiser. But I mean, there's just so much awesomeness happening through all of this. I mean, 40 restaurants simultaneously are having a paired dinner with a winery that for the most part comes from California. But yeah, now they're kind of coming from all over the world. And so everybody's working in harmony, in sync together. Then there's always a great little after party at pools. My liver hates me right now. And it's just a good time to come together. And yeah, everybody is, you know, everyone's there, yes, to have fun, but they're really there to support this amazing cause.
Yeah. And you know what the cool thing is? Like, not only do we get a who's who, like the Jasmine Hirsches of the world and Jim Clendenin and all these great people that impacts Manly, all these really well-regarded winemakers to come down here and be a part of this, but like, you have access to these people. You can go up and talk to them. You can come to the parties. All you got to do is like buy a ticket for the dinner and the gala, and then yeah, you're there.
And start a podcast and just force Jasmine to come into this room and
or
talk.
That, yeah. Or yeah, that.
But let's talk about some wine. Let's talk about what you do.
Yeah,
and by the way, exactly, your dad is like the Bob Dylan of winemakers and vineyard managers.
And I think he quotes Bob Dylan sometimes. I think he does. Well, about the wine.
I'm sure you don't remember because you're traveling all the time, but we actually met at, again, I was a Sommet Boulay. Thankfully, may he rest in peace, Jean-Luc Ledoux, who was making wine with you guys, who just passed away last month, sadly. He was the head sommelier at Danielle for years when they won Best Wine Program, and then he had Ledoux's, which in Tribeca, New York, was this great wine shop.
I've never seen my father more hungover than after a night with Jean-Luc.
With Jean-Luc, yes.
They were... A lot of cognac was consumed. Yeah. A lot of rock and roll.
I think I might have been pouring some of that cognac that night. So
it's a very, very sad, I mean.
Yeah.
I miss you, Jean-Luc. We all do.
Yeah. He was such a good man. And so he actually brought us together because you guys did a dinner with the wines that he was making at Boulay. And
with Andy Pay, I think.
It might have been there too. And yeah, you're probably right.
Vanessa Wong was there, the winemaker for Pay. That was a great night.
Yes.
I remember it well.
Yes, that's right.
That was
totally
a great dinner.
And so I met your father that night, and there is a connection with Bob Dylan there, like something else. Like he quotes him, but is there, like, were they friends? They had met
no,
at some
no,
point?
No, dad, but my dad's like of that era. I mean, he saw all, you know, he used to go to the jazz fest in New Orleans, and but long before he was in the wine business, he was in the clothing business. But he loved, I mean, he's seen Louis Armstrong play, he's seen Bob Dylan, he's seen all the greats. Just huge, you know, music lover, record collector. I remember being a kid and my dad would sit and he'd have a drink and he'd sit in his armchair and he would put records on and he wouldn't do anything. I'm like, Dad, what are you doing? He's like, I'm listening to the music.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think we do that with mm-hmm. anything anymore.
No.
We don't sit and taste the wine. We don't sit and talk to each other. You know, we don't sit and listen to music. And that's, you know, my dad, you know, that, and I think it's generational. I think we all need to get more back into that. I think we all hunger for it. Mm. Yeah.
So talk to us though about the Sonoma Coast, about Hirsch Vineyards. You guys are way out there in this crazy place, literally hanging off the edge of the Pacific of the Sonoma County into the Pacific Ocean and making like somewhat cool climate wine out there.
Well, there's so many things to talk about, so, you know, we can go in lots of directions, but...
Just to, like, people that have never maybe heard of your wines before, give them, like, the really...
Yeah, the quick
elevator pitch.
So, my father bought property on the Sonoma Coast in 1978, and, you know...
Good year. Very good year.
The concept of the Sonoma Coast as a viticultural area did not exist.
Right.
You know, nobody was growing grapes there. It was, first it was timber. It was all redwood trees. They were cut down long before my dad got there. And then it was sheep and cattle country. And it was poor, you know.
Yeah.
And so he bought this ranch for next to nothing because nobody wanted to be out there. It was an old sheep ranch. He bought 1,000 acres of land.
Hmm.
And it's crazy to think about it now. And, you know, in that sense, my dad was very... ahead of his time. I mean, he's from
forward
the Bronx.
Thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's from the Bronx. He dropped out of college. He went to Columbia. He's super smart, but he, you know, not really an institution person.
Yeah.
So he dropped out of Columbia in his freshman or sophomore year, and he, you know, it was the 60s. He moved to the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is relatively undeveloped, right? But he never lived on a farm.
Well, then you had like Martin Ray and Ridge back then.
And that definitely was part of his entry to Pinot Noir. Mm. But he never lived on a farm or a ranch. And it's kind of crazy to think about this, you know, lower middle class working kid from the Bronx.
Right.
coming up to this ranch, which is, it's literally in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you stand at Hirsch and you look at the hills, you don't see any other buildings. Hmm. We're on dirt roads. When he bought the property, we were off the grid for water, which we are to this day. 12-volt electricity.
It's actually probably a good thing, California, yeah, and water.
You're, we're like, very, very fortunate.
I got my own. I'm good.
Yeah.
We're still regulated by the state, but with water, but 12-volt electricity and a one-room shack.
Mm.
And he looked at this place and thought, oh, this would be a great place to live. Now, my mom, who's from rural Alabama, looked at that place and said, I have spent my entire life trying to get away from places like this. Like, yeah. No way. But, you know, my dad, he says now, you know, the place chose me. But, and that may very well be the case, but he was also receptive to it.
Yeah, he was listening.
Yeah, he's very open to the unknown and to complexity. And that is very helpful for farming Pinot Noir and for farming high-end wine grapes in general. Mm-hmm. You know, homogeny is antithetical to complexity in wine. We have a lot of grapes, a lot of vines that have, you know, phylloxera, that have leaf roll virus. You know, these are diseases that you can't get rid of until you replant. And most people, you know, and of course we will at some point tear out and replant, but like, you know, most people would say, oh, I don't want that in my vineyard. It's lower yields. It's much more difficult to farm. It's vine by vine farming. You know, you can't just get on your tractor and just farm, you know. But that's what gets my father excited. And he has this big capacity for the, you know, this complexity. He always says, you know, the original meaning of the word perfect does not mean without flaw. It means complete. So it must include the imperfect. And I think when you taste a lot of wine now, the wines are so fucking perfect.
Mm.
Can I use that word?
Of course.
Perfect?
We're not.
Perfect? Yeah, perfect. Okay, right? They're so boring.
Yeah.
You know, and
homogenized.
Yeah, and it's very interesting when you taste wine with older wine drinkers, you know, people who've been drinking for a long time and drank a lot of wines, you know, from the 70s and the 80s, you know, before things really got perfect in the modern sense, you know. They had a lot higher tolerance for botrytis in Chardonnay. They had a lot higher tolerance for Brett in red wines. And we don't have that tolerance anymore because most of us don't, because the wines that are made now are made, they're so clean because we have really good enology. And, you know, for the most part, modern wine science is a boon to us as drinkers, but it also means that there's a lot of wines that are just so lacking in individuality. And I think Pinot Noir is not a grape that lends itself to being a, you know, wild wine. Like, you know, rustic Pinot Noir is not really that interesting. Like Syrah can be this super noble, you know, shot of Hermitage, and then it can also be this like rustic village San Josep, you
smoky,
know.
Meaty.
Right, and it can really play both sides. I don't think that's true.
Pinot personally wants to wear the elegant dress
Pinot
every
wants
day.
Wants to wear a nice dress. Right? Mm. It's more of a Grace Kelly, but can also it should have this very contained individuality and a certain element of wildness. So our site can produce wines that do have tannin. And that's a bit unusual, I'd say, in New World Pinot Noir. And it's super, super important. And we want to foster that and protect it. And that's one reason why we pick a little bit on the earlier side, relatively speaking, is to preserve that tannin. So, you know, but that all of those priorities really come from my father and his spirit and his expansiveness in regards to this kind of thing.
So that style also then kind of breeds to something that was important in your life. Like, weren't you very instrumental in creating In the Pursuit of Balance? And
it was, you know, Raj and I co-founded In Pursuit of Balance. We call it IPOB for short.
Raj Parr, you're talking about.
Raj Parr.
Who's,
not Raj from What's Happening.
Directed Michael Mina Beverage Restaurants and also makes Sandy Wines now.
And Tony De La Cote.
And every sommelier looks up to him.
Just an awesome, really important person in our industry and somebody I love dearly. It really came about because when I started working for my father in 08, I had just spent a couple of years in New York. I was working in finance. I did not love my job. and a lot of my happiness came from spending late nights out drinking Burgundy. And because of my dad, I had met some collectors and sommeliers, and so I wasn't working in the wine business, but got to kind of enjoy some of the wine community, and people are so generous. Collectors, they, you know, kind of by nature, I think, whether you collect stamps or, I don't know, panda carcasses or, you know, wine, you're sort of like, it's
like that your brain went to panda
solitary,
carcasses.
You know, yeah. I was trying to think of some charismatic megafauna that everybody loves. It's really not.
It's panda carcasses. Totally.
I shouldn't talk negative about pandas, but, you know, biodiversity
those pandas.
Is more important.
It's about time somebody took a stand against those vegetarian puffballs.
I mean, they're eating all the bamboo and, you know, they're just the
How
worst.
Dare they?
Procreate for once, will you? Damn celibate pieces
Get
of shit.
Job. Yeah. Anywho, I just think that collecting is kind of a solitary activity. It's something, you know, by its nature, whatever it is that you collect. But wine is not that. It's so much better when you get some people around the table that can get excited about what you're excited about. And you really see that, I think, in wine collecting, even though it can also be kind of,
daunting and erudite.
Well, right, and like I just showing off my bottle's bigger than your bottle, that kind of thing. But I have to say, there's so much generosity within the wine community and the wine collecting community. So I just got to drink all these great Burgundies. I come home to California and I start tasting my family's wines, and I'm like, I don't really love these wines. And what's up with California Pinot Noir? And Raj was like, well, you know, there are some, like Litterai and Avant Climat, that are making Pinot Noirs in California that are evocative of what we look for in Burgundy. They're not Burgundies.
Right.
We're not trying to make Burgundy in California. It'd be un-Burgundian to try to make Burgundy in California, but looking for that sense of place and that transparency and that elegance. So, you know, we said, well, what if we get all these people together in a room? Because, you know, we didn't create the style. The style, you know, or we didn't, and I want to say too, for me, it's not about style. It's about intention.
Yeah.
And then you got to pick a style, you know, settle on a style that supports your intention. Freddie Meunier has been quoted as saying that he has no style. He's a great Burgundy winemaker for your listeners who aren't familiar with his wines. And I think that's bullshit. I think that sounds like a lot of marketing, what I think he means is very true, which is that you have to strip away in order for terroir to shine, right? But in and of itself, like, there's choices that you make in your winemaking so that terroir can shine that do end up kind of being something that we might call style. So my dad is agnostic to style. He drinks Amarone, you know, big, rich red wines one night, and the next night he'll be drinking Chassagne Rouge, you know, a village Pinot Noir that you could read a book through. Super light, delicate red wines. So I'm very narrow in what I like to drink. I think this is another part of this generational thing. But the reason we, you know, over the years, the first few years I started to work at Hirsch, the reason we changed our style, air quotes, was because I said to my dad, I said, look, you know, ripeness, excessive ripeness is a homogenizer. And when we're trying to make individual wines that express all these crazy individual soils that we have at Hirsch, because we're right on the San Andreas Fault, if they all converge on these big, monolithic, homogenous fruit flavors, they're all going to taste the same. Mm. So if we pick a little earlier, we can preserve the difference. And
right.
What's the point of wine if it all tastes the same? Why are we all excited about wine? Because it's endlessly, you know, curious, endlessly interesting, endlessly different. So we need to promote and celebrate difference. We need to all stop planting the same international varieties everywhere. I mean, we're guilty that we grow Pinot Noir, but... the whole purpose of Pinot Noir is to express place. So, you know, In Pursuit of Balance, the organization, I think there was a diversity of styles in the room, but everybody was committed to making wines that were honest and evocative of the vineyard.
I want to just, for our listeners that might not understand what you were just saying in the terms of technical, you know.
Dumb it down, Matt.
Yeah. When you make wine on a very basic level, the longer you leave it on the vine, the higher sugar levels, the higher potential alcohol, the more, let's say, for the sake of argument, the more sexy a wine can be. It can be powerful. It can have a lot of alcohol. But as you leave it on the vine longer, acidity goes down. So you have less structure in the wine, less freshness in the wine, less of those fresh fruit flavors, let's say. And so you're having, like you say, a more homogenized version because everything just tastes high alcohol, sugary, and sweet.
Yeah, it's when people say, oh, this is flabby. Like, what does that mean? It's like, well, it's just like if you didn't go to the gym for as long as I haven't gone to the gym, you get flabby. But if you work out all the time and you got a nice, you know, six pack going in a grape, it's going to have a little bit of sugar, but it's also going to have some acid. It's going to have some tannin. It's going to have everything that you kind of want because it's worked out.
Yeah, it's complexity. And at the end of the day, like you said, it shows off the place.
We partnered up with Triangle Wine Company because these guys are awesome. They offer weekly wine tasting events, a wide range of wine and beers from around the world, and an easy online store to find the wines that you like. They also offer pickup, local delivery, and shipping. We even set up a promo code NCFB so you can receive 10% off all future purchases.
Go to TriangleWineCo.com or one of their three locations, and for $99, pick up the NCFNB six-pack, which includes three white wines, three red wines, and we threw an official NCFNB hat in the bag.
So once again, buy your wine online or in-store at the Triangle Wine Company and use our promo code NCFB during checkout to receive 10% off your future wine and beer purchases. Go to TriangleWineCo.com or click the top of our website at NCFBpodcast.com.
Hi, this is Mike Coscarelli from Anxiety Now.
And Andrea Allen from the Hot Mess Comedy Hour.
We just launched the brand new OG Podcast Network and wanted to let you know that you can hear ours and other great shows by going to OGPodcastNetwork.com.
Also, be sure to follow the network on social media to keep up to date with new shows, videos, and live events.
That's at OG Podcasts on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Or you can subscribe to your favorite OG podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
So intention, to go back to style, to distill that down also, it's like my intention then as a winemaker is to make the best expression of this vineyard as I possibly can. So in order to do that, I can't really have a style, but then it might manifest itself in a style and like what you do to find out that your initial intention.
Well, it's fascinating because I think, first of all, we're in the new world, right? My dad always says, you know, remember the adjective, it's new. So how do we know what's the best expression of this site? And I think when we go to the traditional wine growing regions of the world and they're still experimenting, let us take note, because, you know, we think we know so much in the new world about our sites and everything. It's like, we don't know shit all. And I, you know, this question of what is the wine that will most encapsulate and highlight the specificity of this little vineyard. I was in the Nahe, which is in Germany, a great Riesling growing region outside of Frankfurt. And at Dornhof, this one of the best winemakers in the region, they had taken this Grand Cru vineyard and they had made sweet wine from it, and they had made Grossgewächs, they'd made dry wine from the same vintage, from the same vineyard. And I was totally confounded by this. I said, well, what's the terroir of this vineyard? Is it supposed to be a sweet wine or a dry wine? And to be honest, he gave me an answer that I don't think I was satisfied by, because I don't know exactly what the answer was. But I think the thinking about it now, what's extraordinary about that vineyard was the amount of ripeness it could achieve, that they could then make either, the fact that they had the choice, it was incredibly far north. But I think the point being, you know, that idea of the dry Grand Cru wines is new in Germany.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're exploring and playing with that, partly for marketing reasons, because there's less of an appetite out in the world for sweet wines anymore.
Sure.
So they're partly driven by necessity. But I just thought, wow, that's so amazing. You have this place where people have been growing grapes for 1,000 years, probably about, and they're still trying to figure it out. So we don't know.
Yeah.
But what I will tell you is we have a 68-acre vineyard that is divided into 60 parcels, 6-0, which is a crazy degree of fragmentation. An acre is not that big. And it's driven by us being on top of a fault line. So this is young land. You've got clay, rock, sand, you know, loam, and all the mixtures and all the different aspects. And the only way to farm it is to farm it in these little parcels, because they're all different and they respond differently. So you got to kind of figure out what each one needs. And then, you know, the reason my dad, who's a farmer, decided to build a winery, which he's really not very interested in. He's not really interested in winemaking. He said, you know, he decided to build a winery to become a better farmer. He said, I want to taste each of the little 60 blocks. And so when you go in the cellar at Hirsch, you can taste 60 little wines, all from the Hirsch vineyard, from the same vintage, from the same winemaker. And if they all taste the same, but you know they're all different, what are you doing?
Right. What's you're not doing point? A good job farming
so
them.
So pull back. Well, you're not doing a good job on your picking decisions and your wine. They're all taste the same because you've made them in such a ripe, over-the-top, extracted way. Now, what if you were to find a way to make the wines where you preserved the specificity of each block, yet they're still delicious? They can still be sexy, actually. And then you have the feedback from the wine that says, okay, this parcel actually really, this is what's going on over here. And this is what's going, this one is more fruity and this one is more earthy. And this has this interesting like piney thing going on. And this one, wow, look at the like sexy tannins over here. And then you really start to like learn about your site. And my dad knew so much about the vineyard before he ever made wine, but he became a better farmer when we started to make our wines.
Right.
And, you know, make our own wines. And I think that that's the ultimate feedback from farming is the wine. And so we got to make the wines in a way that allows us to actually see the vineyard and see our farming decisions and then put that information back in next vintage.
Yeah.
So if we're homogenizing the wines through any of our choices, we're losing that opportunity. And as drinkers, all the wines are going to taste the same, and that's boring.
Right.
So
just to wrap that up, that goes back to the intention of, it's true, we are the new world, but your dad, especially at this time, knows when he's farmed in a good year because the wine is then expressing itself. So when you've done 40 vintages, and I know it's 40 vintages because you said he bought it in 1978, which was a great year, which was the year I was born, and I know I just turned 40. So, but then you do have knowledge to be like, wow, that year was great. So, but then I would assume your style means you go back to like, okay, what did I do? What was my technique in the vineyard or in the winery to like somewhat recreate that or get that expression again?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the same winery in the Naha, the father of the son who I was tasting with, Helmut Donhoff, there's a quote attributed to him. He said, you know, if God was just, he would give winemakers every vintage twice. But, you know, we don't get every vintage twice.
Right.
Every vintage once.
Mm.
And I think that some vintages are alike, but everything's changing all the time. The vines are getting older. The weather's changing. Now the climate's changing too, right?
Right.
We're changing.
Well, not according to some people. It's not changing the climate.
But certainly the weather's changing.
Everything's great.
You know, you can say the climate is the same. It's just weather, right? Right. So, yeah. But
and you got to sometimes just put a flag in the sand and say, okay, we're going to do Pinot. Like, yes, I got to let this area speak to me and we're going to do something. But you also have to make decisions. You have to choose what you're going to do. So there is a little bit of a style. There is a little bit of an idea. And then from whatever you pick, you react to what happens, and your dad has done it like it has an exceptional way for so long. So it's always a pleasure. You know, if you're going to get a Hirsch Vineyards wine, no matter what label's on it, it's going to be a damn good wine.
Yeah,
100%.
Yeah.
Real quick, couple of things before we get out of here. So you were in finance before you came back to work for your dad.
That's a fancy word for it. I was in private banking.
Okay. Yeah, you were in finance. So what brought you, because the reason I'm asking, just before we walked in here, we were privy to a pretty cool conversation about you talking about you having a say in how the wine's made and why you couldn't go to BevCon, because that's when a lot of the harvest is done. And if you don't have a seat at the table, you literally don't have a seat at the table. So two questions, your name's on the label also. So how much say do you have on the wine? How does that work? And then, yeah, how did you decide let me get in on dad's business?
Well, the second question in regards to how I came to work for my father, I just really wasn't enjoying my job and in finance in New York City. And I was complaining about it to my friend Bernie Sun, who used to run wine for Jean Georges.
Yep.
For all his U.S. restaurants, and very, very impressive person who I am honored to call a friend and really look up to.
Smart enough to hire Aldo Sahm,
yes,
as well.
Yes. He gave Aldo his job.
Yeah.
So Bernie said, you know, quit complaining. What do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, I love food and wine. And he said, well, go work for your dad. And I said, I can't work for my dad. That's dumb, right? You know, we're Americans. You know, none of this nepotism stuff. And he said, you know, you're being an idiot. Your dad's doing something really important. You should go home and help him. And you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was at a point in my life where I was just like, I was really unhappy. And I think I was feeling sorry for myself. And I didn't feel motivated to go out and like figure out what to do. And having that person that I respected, that third party outside the family saying, not only is it okay to go home and work for your family, but you should.
Yeah. And I got to talk to Bernie more. Yeah. Nobody ever gives me concrete advice.
Yeah.
It's always like, well, what do you think you should do? Or how are you feeling about that? No.
Thanks, therapist. I just gave you a bunch of money. Tell me what to do.
What the fuck is what's the right answer?
I think it's also like, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but, you know, Bernie's Chinese and he had no time for my self-pity.
Right.
And he said, "Get you know, quit that.
I got
and
shit
he,
to do. Here's what you should do.
Yeah, and he said, don't be an idiot. Go work for your father. And it's the hardest thing I've ever done, and it's the best thing I've ever done. And the most rewarding thing I've ever done is work for my father.
Do you have siblings?
I do.
Are they involved?
No, but my younger brother works in wine and loves wine. He works for Planner in New York City. My brother Joe.
Yeah, Dougie P.
Yeah, and he does an amazing job. I'm so proud of him. He's an incredible, you know, member of the wine community in New York City and loves wine. And my sister is in real estate and not super interested in wine, but you know, she has kids, so that's the real family business right there, right? So she's got
and somehow kids. When somebody buys a new house, they get a bottle of Hirsch as their welcoming
she's
gift.
Yeah. And then in regards to your question about affecting the wines, you know, I'm not a winemaker,
right?
I'm not a farmer. I'm the general manager of our winery, but I'm younger than our winemaker. And less experienced than and younger than our vineyard manager and much less experienced. Our vineyard manager, Averardo Robledo, has been with us for almost 30 years. He lives on site. He's raised 4 kids there. He's still raising 2 of them. So if I want to be taken seriously when we have conversations about farming decisions leading up to harvest or picking decisions, you know, I got to be there. And I do all of our sales, which requires a lot of travel.
Yeah, you're everywhere. Like, following your Instagram feed is like, gives me, you know, like, hurts my neck.
Anxiety, yeah.
Yeah, you get miles, though, on United just for following me on Instagram. So now
seriously? I got how do I cash in on those? Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, I mean, that's the thing. There's no such thing as armchair farming. There's no such thing as armchair, you know, living, right? If you want to, you know, I think Woody Allen or somebody said, you know, it's like, you know, if you don't show up, you've missed life. I forget what he's a much better quote about it than I do. But, so I got, come middle of August, I stay home so that I can be a part of that and learn, frankly.
What are some of those decisions that are being made and those conversations that are happening that, you know, that you want to have a say in specifically?
Well, thinning, which is a farming practice that we do before we pick, where we go into the vineyard and we actually cut fruit off.
Yeah.
And you have to do it before the fruit is finished coloring up. Because if you wait, then it all is the same color and you can't distinguish what you want to cut off and what you want to leave. And, you know, the winery is, you know, we're really focused on quality. And so sometimes that means cutting fruit off. And the vineyard, you know, you grow the grapes. It's sometimes there's an emotional thing where it's hard to cut fruit off. And so there's usually some back and forth between Averardo and our winemaker about how much we're going to drop off. And, you know, I want to be there to hear both sides because, you know, and then kind of
be like an arbitrator.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But also just kind of understand, you know, this is really what we need to do. Now, this year, 2017, this past harvest, it was really how we had a heat wave coming. And our vineyard manager was very anxious to finish the thinning because he said, you know, if we don't finish now, everything's going to color up and we're going to run out of time because we're going to have to start picking. Same guys that do the thinning do the picking. So he was urging our winemaker, you know, Anthony, you got to let me know. But, you know, Anthony said, you know what? I'm looking at all the different blocks and unusually this year, all of the blocks were a little closer together in terms of ripeness. So Anthony's thinking, wow, all this fruit's going to get ripe at the same time. And we don't have enough guys to pick it. We don't have enough people in the winery to process it. So stop thinning. Because the more fruit you leave, the more it'll slow it down. Now, that's a crazy thing for a vineyard manager to hear from a winemaker. You don't want me to drop fruit. You want to actually leave the fruit. So it was this really interesting. And then when Anthony explained to Averato why he wanted fruit left, Averato was like, okay, awesome. We're going to go work on other things. And we still were doing obviously some thinning, some fine tuning or whatever. But it was really... Because I was like, Anthony, don't we need to like thin? You know, so it was such an incredible learning experience. And it, again, it comes to this thing that every vintage is different. And if you're not there in the vineyard making those critical decisions that 24 hours can make a huge difference, then you're going to miss it. And, and you know, great wine is 1,000 little tiny decisions, to quote Jean-Marc Rouleau. So if you miss one of those little decisions, okay, fine. But if you miss, you miss 10 of them, you miss 100 of them.
You starts that up.
Great wine anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Very cool.
Well, that's. I felt like I was in the room for those decisions right now. That was amazing.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing us in.
No, thank you so much.
Thanks, you guys.
Yeah. Say hello to California for us.
Awesome. Yeah.
And we appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. My pleasure. Go follow. What's your handle?
It's Jasmine Hirsch.
Jasmine Hirsch.
H-I-R-S-C-H.
Yeah.
Or Hirsch Vineyards.
Yeah. And go follow their wine. Learn about great Pinot Noir coming out of Sonoma Coast.
Today, we are visited by Daniel Lewis, president of the Outer Banks Restaurant Association, and also the proprietor of three great restaurants out there, Coastal Provisions, Cravings Steak and Seafood, and Coastal Cantina. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're a busy man.
I am.
We've got the 2018 OBX Taste of the Beach Festival happening over the weekend of the 22nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
Correct.
And so we're going to be there as judges, and we might get our hands dirty and play around with some cocktails. But Dan, let's talk about what's going on with that festival and why everybody should show up.
Sure. Well, the Taste of the Beach started probably more than 25 years ago on the Outer Banks as a wintertime locals event. And with the advent of the food culture, you know, Food Network and all that, and additional festivals coming on board, the then president saw what was going on in Charleston with the wine and food festival that's going on down there and decided to make the Taste of the Beach more than just a single event. So we, about 2008, I believe, was the first year we switched it to a four-day event, invited all of the members to host their own events like wine dinners or tapas crawls or whatnot, and still have it culminate it with a big grand tasting, as we call it, which is more the traditional where all the chefs get together and do their foods and beverages.
So the grand tasting is on Sunday. That's kind of the end of the event, and that's where it culminates. But prior to that, leading up, what are a couple of big events that everybody would be excited about?
Well, we host a couple big events on Friday. We have the Barbecue and Wings Showdown, sponsored by Cisco Foods and Smithfield's, kicking in a bunch of pork for us as well.
Judged by Max and Matt of the NCF&B podcast.
We hope so.
Well.
You ready for some pork?
Can we have a preview right now?
Unfortunately, no. Actually, so we got that going on Friday afternoon, and that's over across the bridge on the Currituck mainland.
Nice.
And then Saturday at my place, I actually host one of the larger events, is the Chowder Cook-Off, which is about 10 years running. We have about 600 people in for that. About a dozen to 18 or so chowder participants on that. And then Sunday, as you mentioned, the grand tasting.
Cool. And to get tickets, can you get a full pass to attend anything, or is it you have to buy individually?
Yeah, all the tickets are available on the website, which is obxtasteofthebeach.com. They are all sold individually, so you can pick and choose at your leisure as far as, you know, if you're only going to be down for 1 or 2 days, you can pick like the Friday, Saturday events. Hopefully you can stay for the full 4 days. We do have a few events that start on Thursday night as well.
Okay. If you want to be centrally located, where should you stay?
The grand tasting is going to be held at the Hilton Garden Inn in Kitty Hawk, and that's pretty much centrally located. You have the Northern Beaches, the Duck and Corrala restaurant events north of there, and anything south, Kitty Hawk, Killdevil Hills, Nag's Head south of there.
So we're going to get started Thursday, March 22nd, and it's going to run Thursday, Friday, Saturday, finish on Sunday, the 25th. So go to obxtasteofthebeach.com, look for the event that suits you best, and hit us up on social while you're there, and maybe we'll give you a little shout out and say hi. So
maybe even pour you a drink.
The website's really set up nicely. You can have search functions. So if you want to search by specific restaurant or type of an event, whether it be a tapas crawl or a wine dinner or a specific area, you know, for those of you that might even be interested in, you know, hanging out at the Outer Banks for a season or a little longer, we actually also just added a restaurant job board as well. So you can actually go to the Obra tab and find a job.
The work.
Yeah, exactly.
We can use
hang
that.
Hanging on the coast.
Yeah, you guys want to hang out for the season?
We might. Just a podcast from out there and eat some great oysters.
I'm going to need a grand suite at the Sanderling.
Yeah, we'll see if we made that happen. Not.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for giving us your time right here. We will see you in a couple weeks. Matt, what do you got?
Thanks, Daniel. This has been really great to learn about it, and I, for one, am very much looking forward to joining. So,
well, great. My pleasure.
Everybody, go to obxtasteofthebeach.com. Come out and join us on the Outer Banks from the weekend of March 22nd to the 25th, and you will eat and drink very merrily.
Well, we are back at the Triangle Wine Experience. What do we have in studio now, Matt?
So, I mean, it has been a who's who, but this is potentially the biggest fish in the pond here. We mentioned him on our last edition of our interviews with Jasmine. Was talking about Mr. Raj Parr. What did you call him?
He's the guy that every psalm looks up to.
Yeah. I think that's dead on.
I wish.
You have so many projects going on. Sandy Wines, right?
Yep.
Are you still involved with Michael Mina? You're still the corporate beverage director there, yeah.
Not as involved. First of all, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. And
thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure being in Raleigh and being a part of the Triangle Wine Experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still work with Michael, but mostly on new projects.
Okay.
And things, just development things and not as involved as I was back in the day, but slowly getting more and more involved back since I was busy setting up, Sound the Evening Land and doing the Lakota. And now that they've kind of been set up and we know the wines you make and distribution is kind of pretty much all set up, so I have some time to do other things and definitely been working with Michael since 2002, so it's just hard to, completely let go. So
yeah, but it's probably good for both of you to be involved with each other still at this point.
Oh, for sure. It's a long relationship, 15 years. So.
So is this like the new trend? You work at very high-level beverage programs of well-known restaurateurs, and then eventually you just start making your own wine? Is that the thing? Oh, we were kidding, because we had Jordan Salcido on recently, and then, of course, Patrick Capiello was on when we were at BevCon, and that's kind of like a cool...
Yeah, I would say probably like you and Greg Heron. Maybe Greg was like the first to really like branch out and be successful.
Yeah, before Greg, actually, the very first was, again, people might know him, he was... Michael Bonacorsi.
Right.
He was at Spago, and you know, if you're living in California, you have an edge because the vineyards are right there. So between 2004 and 2008, I made some wine with Jim Clendenin. It was a 4-hour drive from me to Aubon Climat. And then after 2009 till 2013, I was working on RN74 the floor every day, and then in end of 2013, I moved to Santa Barbara to live there full time and be near the vineyards and just more involved. You have to be there. You have to be right at the source. It's difficult, It's like, you know, I don't call myself a sommelier because sommeliers work on restaurant floors. I don't. I oversee a team of people who kind of do a great job, and I kind of help them in a way. So I make wine, and if you make wine, you're in the winery, in the vineyard. You're close to source. If you're going to be a sommelier, you're going to be on the restaurant floor. So, it's a very clear cut. But I kind of do, in a way, do both, just to kind of, because one job is like you can't leave something you've done for so long.
Right.
And you can, but you don't want to because you're so attached to it. So.
Was this part of the game plan for you when you were you were a kid? Did you know or think you were ever going to be a winemaker?
Nothing. Not even close. I wanted to be a chef, and I ended up becoming a sommelier, and then I was making a little bit of wine just for fun, just to kind of check it out, see how to grow grapes, make wine. It was completely just a small hobby learning experience, and then we found the right place where, which now is Domaine de la Cote, and Then we had a chance to take over Seven Springs Estate in Oregon and couldn't say no to that. And, you know, it just kind of went from there.
Domaine de la Côte is your newest project, right?
Well, Domaine de la Côte was planted in 07. We acquired it in 2012.
Okay.
In its entirety. Sandy was before that.
Yeah.
Sandy started in 2009. So it all happened around the same time. And then Eveningland was the last one, which we took over in 2014. So what we have right now is 2014 Chardonnay from Eveningland. So
yeah.
That's our first vintage of a historic estate, which has been around since the early 80s, actually.
Yeah, and for those people, it's interesting because, and I asked you earlier offline what the clone is of this, and so for those of you that think that Matt's about to get into wine geek speak, you know, just bear with me for a second because I like talking about Oregon Chardonnay because for a long time, Oregon Chardonnay, for lack of a better word, was fucked up because they were planting on the wrong clone, so it didn't really fit the soil or the matter, but now that's pretty much been rectified all around where yeah. Now we're seeing some, I mean, just out there, Jim Clendenin was joking. He was like, oh, I don't like Chardonnay from Oregon. And then he tasted yours and he's like, oh, I gotta X that out of the old vocabulary.
Yeah. It's definitely, you know, it's going to get more and more interesting in the coming years because a lot of producers are now focusing on Chardonnay from the right places, growing the right way, better viticulture, of course, better plant material. And then, in the end, good winemaking. So all of it will, I think, produce wines like this in the future for sure.
Okay. And so essentially you have three different projects with the with winemaking.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So
actually I have
more than that.
A couple more, which are kind of smaller. One is called Combe. It's a small project with Pete Stolpman.
Okay.
From Stolpman
yeah.
in Ballard Canyon. So that's
fantastic vineyard. Yeah.
Yeah. So we
You're making Syrah with him? Or?
No, we have a little Trousseau.
Okay.
Trousseau Noir. And we have some Chenin Blanc.
Nice.
So we do that with him. And then me and Sashi then play around, make some other small, different fun things, which we're starting a small wine club this year. It's going to be, we have everything from Napa Valley Cabernet, Merlot. Some Syrah, some Mondus, Pinot Blend, just different things. Just some fun wines, and so we, you know, always keep it interesting. And
you're talking about Sashi Moorman, who's your business partner in
this.
Yes,
my business partner, and yeah.
So Raj, for the people that might not know of you, and we've given you your due introduction, just tell us a little bit about, yeah, how you came up, and you said you wanted to be a chef, but then you became a sommelier, and how did you kind of rise to become corporate beverage director of Michael Mina?
I'll keep it short. So I was born in India, in Calcutta, and since I was little, I wanted to be a chef, so I went to hotel school in India, and then I started to cook there, and I came to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York in 94, graduated, fell in love with wine at the same time, and started working at a Rubicon restaurant with Larry Stone, my mentor and you know, a really good friend, and I worked with him for 3 years. Then I started working in another restaurant in San Francisco called Fifth Floor, met Michael Mina there, and then Michael and myself started talking, and he had these plans to start this company and build the Mina Group, and we started working together in late 2002, and then in the whole process, I kind of fell in love with, you know, growing grapes, making wine, and all these things happened. Opened RN74, which was our homage to Burgundy, and that restaurant, we just closed it last October, but that had a good 8-year run. Wrote a book with Jordan McKay, Secrets of Sommelier. That was released in 2011, and we just finished our new book. It will be released in October of 2018, called The Atlas of Taste.
Nice.
So just, yeah, all these things have happened and met amazing people and just, you know, I still travel a bunch. And
yeah, you're everywhere.
Yeah, where is your home at this point?
Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara.
Yeah, I live there.
Yeah. Oh, you mentioned it. Yeah.
I probably spend less than 100 days a year there, but those 100 days are precious. And yeah, it's pretty amazing to meet so many amazing people around the world and talk wine and talk food and just
What did you? What was your contribution to the Triangle Wine Experience this weekend?
I'm here very short because we had some stuff happening in Santa Barbara. I couldn't get away, so I came here last night. Had a dinner. Had a wine dinner with Richard Betts and Carla.
Mm-hmm.
We did a dinner at Sono.
Oh yeah,
and it was great. And that was that today. Today this, and then I'm doing a little tasting at the Raleigh Wine Shop after this.
Nice.
And tomorrow in the afternoon I'm heading off to Europe. So,
how many years have you been coming down here for this?
I was here 2 years ago. It's my second time here.
Second time. And so, how'd you get involved to begin with?
Through PAX, and then PAX met Eliza and
speaking of PAX Mali, and he's been on our podcast back when we were down in
BevCon. Yeah,
BevCon. We had a nice little forum chat with John Bonnet, Grayson Schmidt, Patrick Capiello, and PAX Mali.
Yeah.
Talking Syrah with people all over the country. It was pretty fun.
Yeah, no, he's a dear, dear friend, and so he's, you know, we try to do some events together, and he's like, you got to come down to Raleigh. I'm like, sure, why not?
Yeah.
Yeah. Your wine is well received down here, and people are into it. And so, what would you say what do you tell? I'm sure you get asked this all the time. Other sommeliers who want to make their own wine or who want to do that transition.
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, if you're going to make the wine, then you got to be there and make the wine. Unless you want someone else to make the wine, that's fine too. But you know, spend time in the place you're going to make wine. If you're going to make wine in New York State, or if you're going to make wine in Virginia or in California, Oregon, Washington, just you got to be there. You got to be close to the fruit source. You got to, you know, be there to the whole process and really kind of, because the wine is a reflection of you. If you taste any of our wines, and if you know me, if you know Sashi, they're reflections of us. They're not. These wines are, you know, as you know, it's the wines are characterized after people. And if you're going to make wine, it better be a very personal wine because that's very important. Not just a wine you put your label on and say, this is my wine.
Right.
But to be so, just be connected and, you know, make wine for the right reason, not necessarily to, you know, make a lot of wine or make a lot of money. That's not the idea. The idea is to make a wine that makes a difference, make a wine that really is from the place. So, yeah.
I think at the end of the day, and this has been reminding me a lot, it's a wine that you yourself would drink. And we talked, that was one of the main takeaways I got from our wine forum back in BevCon is that PAX and Patrick and John, you know, I like to get to the entry points of when movement started. And both PAX and Patrick were saying, you know, we weren't drinking our own wine. Like,
yeah, if it was a party, you'd show up with something from the Rhone. And
that was later when you and I were talking with PAX the other night at a great party. But they were saying...
And he ripped off that San Josef wine label.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
But no, they were saying, you know, we have... It's like almost scary because you have this arguably great, you know, world-class vineyards in your backyard, and you're not drinking the stuff that you're making there because your style is not what you prefer. So it's like... Make the wine that you want to drink.
Yeah,
for sure.
And maybe it's easier said than done. You got to understand how to do it in this environment. Like if you're in California, how do we make these wines taste like old world wine? So you have to be pretty smart and heady about the winemaking process.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's also taking dedication to figure out that path is the important aspect of it.
Yeah, and I also think it's a business decision, right? Because people are making wines of the fashion, obviously, and what's getting scores? Well, a guy like Robert Parker is tasting hundreds of wines sitting down in one setting. Well, what's going to stick out? The ones that the flashiest, the ones that's highest in alcohol is going to stick out. And remember, when you're tasting hundreds of wines, so that's like, okay, so Scores sells wines, and now I got to get big scores. So how do I get big scores? I make big flashy wine, and then it's just a vicious cycle.
Yeah, no, it's
but you don't do that. You make wines that are very personal to you, and
for sure, that's our number one goal is to kind of course, make the wine from the place and make the wine which, you know, we would actually drink. Because, you know, I don't know, that's just maybe it's cliche, but it's for us, it's true. You know, we actually enjoy these wines, and we don't drink much of our wines actually. It's very rare. We at home never. You know, I'll taste current vintage or an older vintage just to kind of taste it, but or in a blind tasting or something, but never, you know, I drink other wines because I want to be exposed to what other people are doing, and
yeah,
that's important.
And you're tasting your wines often, I imagine, when you're blending, right?
Yeah, we don't do that many blendings, unfortunately, because we have a single parcels. Yeah, we do some blending and we taste them, but if you taste them in barrel, barrel tasting, if you're tasting with customers or friends, but other than that, not necessarily a bottle or something, you know. It's mm-hmm. Very rarely I'll open something just to kind of taste and then to move on to, you know, the next wine.
What's it like to be a Indian person in the wine community?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I never thought of that because...
You've only been Indian the whole time you've been in the wine community?
I guess, but it was... You know, it's the wine community is very, very open, very liberal. That's one thing. You know, there's, of course, a lot of racial tension around the country these days. Honestly, I've never felt anything and any of that. It's just been a very open and very engaging and very liberal kind of community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because after all, we're just drinking and eating and chatting. And, you know, it's amazing to meet so many people and become friends. And India is a big part of my life because I was born there. And, you know,
Do you go back?
You know, I used to go back every year when my father was alive. I now don't go back that often. My mom comes visits me once a year, but it's you know, it's the reason I can, you know, taste the way I taste or cook whatever is because of how I grew up and where I grew up. So it's all those aromas and smells and cooking when you're young. So all these things have made me who I am. So I can't forget that
tradition, because traditional Indian cooking has just such a variety of different flavors that you wouldn't normally get. If you're American.
Yeah, it's very different than, like, you know, you make one dish and it could have, like, you know, 10 different spices.
Right. Oh, last night we went to the Lyoko dinner at St. Rock, and that coconut curry soup had, like, 3 different curries or whatever, and it was, like, creamy and spicy and all exotic at the same time. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Is there any wine being made in India?
Yeah. Yeah, there's Sula is the big winery there. They make Chenin Blanc and Sauvignon Blanc and a few others. But, you know, the consumption is very little because...
Right, because culturally...
Yeah, whiskey and beer and...
Mm-hmm.
But they say that, I mean, I'm giving my secrets away, my future plan to become an extremely rich mogul. But they say that the future is in actually exports to India because... That maybe the drinking culture is growing, plus you have a huge tourism culture.
The drinking culture is huge. Indians can drink you on the table.
Right.
I mean, it's huge. The culture is there. It's just the export. The import duties are so high. So you're paying 200%.
Right.
So one day, that's going to come to an end.
But isn't there a loophole? Like if you sell to private clubs or hotels, something like you don't get the tax? I can't remember.
Yeah, there is a loophole, but you won't be able to get mass public then. You'll be only getting the wines to, you know, the fine hotels and restaurants, but you want to get to everyone.
Do you sell your wines at all in India? No.
No, I have a guy who's working on something, and I believe he'll eventually get there, and then we'll do it, because, you know, it's just
put me in on that export company, all right? I'm in for like $5, definitely.
Done.
All right, nice.
But this is fantastic. Raj, thank you so much for coming on in, spending some time with us. We'll get back out there. I'm going to just follow you wherever you go, whoever you're tasting wine. I'm just going to go, I want whatever he's tasting. But thanks for coming down here. Thanks for coming to North Carolina and being a part of the Triangle Wine Experience and being on the NCF&B podcast. Matt?
Absolutely. It speaks to large volumes for what we're doing here and the good cause, the fact that somebody as busy as you and travels as much takes their time to come to this event. So thanks.
It's my pleasure. It's great being here. Thank you.
And delicious wine, by the way. So we'll put some links up on our show notes and you'll be able to figure out where you can access some of the wines.
Cool.
So,
awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thanks for listening to the NCF&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.
My name is Robin Bodwin. I work with Proof Wine and Spirits. I'm a wine sales rep. I spend a lot of time in my car. And you know what I do in my car? I listen to the NC F&B podcast. That's how you find out where all the hot restaurants are. Max and Matt, keep it real. Listen all the time. Love you.